Lee, before we get started, I have to send you a picture because I wanted so bad to use this as a promo photo for this.
You're very technically savvy too, that you can just pop that up and then take it away before I have a chance to poke it.
It did that, Ben. It popped up and then it just disappeared.
Oh, if you go to like the text chat, you can see it.
We can keep it.
Right. But yeah, those were the days.
Yeah, I saw that. Like, I think I was flipping through old percussive notes a while back, and like I was like, this guy thinks he's such a badass smoking cigarettes and playing marimba.
It's pretty badass.
I was for a couple of weeks in the 80s. I was badass.
You know, I should look for a record. I should. I know I have a Stevens record here. Let's see.
You know, while Casey's on the search there, my first record was actually an LP, because the Bach on Marimba, some people might know as a CD, or maybe I don't even know if it's downloadable. I have no idea, out of my department. But originally came out in LP, first with Musical Heritage Society. And then it was right at the dawn of the CD age. So that would have been early 80s, I guess. And it was too short for a CD. And they were doing pretty well with it at Musical Heritage Society. So they wanted me to also put it out in CD, but I was sent back to the studio to do another violin sonata. There you go. Yeah, that's it. That's the one. So that's the nice. First. Actually, maybe that's the second version of the LP. That's the second version.
Is it?
First version through Musical Heritage Society was a black and white cover. I was humiliated. It prompted me further on in life to try to control things more. The cover of the LP in Musical Heritage Society there's something I'm sure you've all seen in the Blades book or whatever. It's like a marimba guy wearing a marimba around his neck.
Yeah,
right.
That's the cover. I didn't think it was particularly appropriate for an all box CD, but anyway, they sent me back months later. I did a second sonata. Probably that LP has two violin sonatas. I'm not even sure. And then it was long enough, so they put it on CD, on Music Masters.
It does, two sonatas, yep.
Yeah. So that was the Musical Heritage Society owned Music Masters. Music Masters was their commercial. This is like trivia that nobody's interested in, but that red one, that was their commercial line. And then Musical Heritage Society, which I guess still exists, because they have an incredible catalog. Maybe it's just mail order, or I don't know how it's available now. That was their club thing. You belong to a club and you got a new LP every month.
Wow. Right. Well, I remember CD clubs like that. God, I was in a CD club. I loved it. I thought it was amazing. I wish that sort of thing still existed. Yeah.
I belonged for a long time to, it's still in existence. You can go to Barnes & Noble and get BBC Music. And BBC Music has a monthly magazine where you get a CD each month. And it's fantastic because I've
probably seen that.
300. Is that would that be right? No, can't be that right. I have 250 anyway. Mm. From BBC Music, and some of them are things that you would never go into. Well, if a record store existed, you would never go in and buy it. But if somebody sends you the CD, then you get exposed to literature you never ever would hear.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Anyway, those days are gone, I think.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to your episode 198 of the At Percussion podcast. Today's date is September 29th, 2019. With me, as always, are Casey Cangelosi.
Hey, everybody.
And Carly Vigna.
Hi, everyone.
Carly, I understand you just went to a very interesting concert at the New World Center.
Yeah, I did. You know, it was a real treat last night. They call it the Percussion Consort. It's kind of their percussion chamber music concerts. They premiered Charles Warren's Symphony No. 2. And then they also did Steve Reich's Sextet. That was the second half. So it was awesome to hear that music at a very high level on the same program in a beautiful hall. Very cool.
Carly, was the Symphony No. 2 as big as in terms of how many players there were as Symphony No. 1?
You know, it was slightly smaller, but I think more tam-tams. Than Symphony No. 1. It was 14 players total, two of which are pianists, and then 12 percussion players.
Yeah, Carly and I, when we were graduate students at the University of Miami, got to perform his Percussion Symphony No. 1 with the New World section and some other UM colleagues. And I think Carly and I played second and third tam tams on it.
Yeah,
they were that involved. That
but I mean, it's that gigantic of a piece. And I mean, our friend Manu played the marimba part on it, and I mean, that thing just looked like an absolute nightmare to put together. But I mean, even just counting through this piece with all of its quirky meters was difficult in and of itself. So I'm sure the New World guys did a wonderful job with that.
They did great. And actually, there were, let's see, I think 7 members of the UM studio playing again, the same way that we did, 6 or 7 years ago?
Yeah.
So it was cool. It was nice to be on the other side, just sit in the audience and enjoy.
Have you seen Warren's spinoff, a piece for congas, bass, and violin? It's a trio.
No.
Oh, well, meters and,
Cool. Well, actually, the interesting thing with the Second Symphony, I didn't see the music, but before playing, Michael Linville said, I think what he said was that the piece is through the same in the same meter throughout, same tempo. It's just
wow.
There are times that it feels, you know, slower, and then times that the pulse seems faster, but it's the same. And it was like 19 minutes, something like that.
Huh.
So it was interesting because I remember, counting was kind of a nightmare in the First Symphony. It was challenging to say the least.
Yes, I know of at least a couple other percussion works. He has a theme and variations for marimba, and he also has a piece for trombone, percussion, and one other, maybe piano, I can't remember. But very difficult music for the performer and the listener. Yeah. Well, today's guest really needs no introduction, but here we go anyway. Today's guest is Lee Howard Stevens. Lee's 5-decade-long career has been spent revolutionizing the art of playing marimba, from performing hundreds of recitals internationally to codifying marimba technique and its method of movement to designing mallets and instruments. He is a Percussive Art Society Hall of Fame member and has been featured in several mainstream publications, including the Wall Street Journal and Time Magazine, which described him as the world's greatest marimbist. He has commissioned and premiered works from Joseph Schwantner, John Serry, and David Maslanka, among others. So welcome to the podcast, Lee Howard Stevens.
Happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
And before we get started, I just wanted to point out that Lee has actually done one other podcast, the Discussions in Percussion podcast. And we all gave that a listen before we're filming this one. So there were quite a few Facebook questions, as you might imagine, and some of them were covered on that podcast, so we're going to try to avoid duplicating information. So there's a lot of information, especially about Lee's musical upbringing and studies with Joe Morello and Vida Chinoweth on that episode, so be sure to check that one out in addition to this one.
It's good. Yeah, they did a great job, and of course Lee did a fantastic job.
Thanks for saying that. I have no idea what we talked about.
Ben and I actually made a list.
It was a couple of years ago.
Marjorie Bram. Yeah, I remember.
Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah, a lot of great stuff. You know, Lee, I just want to show everyone this just because I happen to have it right here. I'm just so lucky to have my predecessor Bill Rice's record collection still in the office. And this is Lee told us this is the second version of the Bach on Marimba record, kids. This is called a record. It's like a big a big MP3 made of vinyl.
So, yeah. Lee, on that Discussions in Percussion podcast, I can't say that title, you mentioned a name that I actually wanted to ask about today regardless, and that is, I know that David Maslanka wrote his Variations on Lost Love for you, and David Maslanka passed away relatively recently, just a year or two ago. And was obviously huge in terms of writing for percussion. Could you tell us about your time working with David Maslanka on that piece?
Be happy to, sure. I didn't know David at all before the New York State Music Educators chose him as the composer of the year. Every couple of years, I guess, they did a commission. And somebody suggested that it be a marimba piece for me, or perhaps that was even David's idea. I don't really know the exact origin. I just know that it wasn't one of the commissions where I actually ponied up the cash. I remember those fondly because in so many cases I was the one ponying up the cash. And in this case, it was sort of a gift to my career that somebody else paid for it. So we met many times. He was teaching at Sarah Lawrence University at the time. And in fact, there were other marimba pieces that follow. As you know, there, of course, My Lady White, sort of the, I'll do this in quote, air quotes, the easier version of Variations on Lost Love. But then there's another one, Orpheus in the Underworld. I think it's for marimba and a couple of bassoons that I premiered also at Sarah Lawrence. So there was a whole cluster of pieces going on at the time that David wrote when he got interested in the marimba. So as I always try to do, I try to slow the composer down a little bit and say, don't write the piece until after we meet, after I show you what I can do and what I can do and haven't been able to do because nobody wrote for it yet. And in some cases, people slow down. And in other cases, by the time the meeting takes place, they have a, you know, a draft of the piece and it's too late. Those are really unfortunate. And that's happened to me a number of times. But David was very circumspect and careful in that regard. And you can tell from the writing that he was fully cognizant of the one-handed roll business, both in individual notes and rolls. I don't remember, although I probably have it in my archives somewhere, whether all of the melodic stuff was originally in octaves or not. A lot of times composers, when they, and I'm sure this is true even today, they learn about the one-handed roll and then they start writing things for one-handed roll, but they really don't sound big and full on the instrument. And sometimes they're almost, well, they're very awkward because they're single note rolls when octaves actually would sound better. So in any event, we went through many drafts. The humorous part of the story, well, I mean, I suppose if David were here, maybe he wouldn't think it was humorous to talk about this, but it's the truth. And it's a cute, quirky little thing. So, you know, in the middle of the piece, if you know the work, there's a sort of a soft shoe. I'll call it a soft shoe variation where it seems to be, seems to go into a much lighter style of music, all pentatonic kind of writing. And in the draft that I got, it included not only those notes, but also temple blocks. So you were switching back and forth between the marimba and temple blocks in this soft shoe thing. And I said to David, I can't play it now. I mean, with temple, it's not that I can't play temple blocks. I graduated from the Eastman School of Music. I had to play temple blocks once or twice. That wasn't the issue, but I didn't want that in a serious marimba piece because I thought it was belittling to the instrument. It was really actually borderline to have the soft shoe in there. But when you put the temple blocks in, it really, I thought it devalued the work. So we battled back and forth about that quite a bit, but we eventually decided we're going to keep the soft shoe in, get rid of the temple blocks. And then this would be sort of a, just a quizzical interlude that that piece goes through. So if you know the piece well, don't dwell too much on the soft shoe because it should be, you know, just sort of a tilt of the head, a quizzical thing, and then get out of it. But that's the origin of that particular piece of musical material.
Has anyone ever tried to put the temple blocks back in?
No, because I don't think anybody's ever seen the score with that. I probably have it about 25 feet behind me. And I have big file folders back there of, you know, a lot of manuscripts and stuff.
I can just imagine people sending you emails after hearing this. Exactly. I don't want to.
Please don't. And I don't. The piece is done anyway. You don't. You wouldn't want to go back into that because many other things were changed in other drafts also. So it's not like that was the only change, but that was the only sort of interesting story where I had to sort of put my foot down and say, no, I'm just not going to play it. If that's plus, I don't want to carry around temple blocks, and you know, temple blocks get all eaten up, and probably at that time they didn't have the really good synthetic ones that they have now, jam blocks or whatever they're called.
Right, right.
But anyway, the point is now we have, it's a very serious piece. It's a neo-romantic piece. He took a lot of crap from a lot of people at the time, as did Raymond Helbel, maybe about the same time, for writing neo-romantic music at a time that the Warnin style, you started out talking about Charles Warnin, that music that was very inaccessible to the audience was what was considered cool, at least in the universities. It was very uncool to write anything that had a tonal center or recognizable tune or had any kind of heartfelt emotion expressed other than very loud, very soft, very loud, very soft.
So I just had a quick follow-up question for that. Carly and I met David Mislanka and worked with him very late in his life. And in fact, my school, I think, was the second to last school. This school here was the second to last school I think he visited in his lifetime. And he was very sort of quiet and reserved and introspective. Was he like that as well in his younger days, or was he a different person back then?
No, always quiet, introspective, gentle, beautiful guy.
Yeah.
In all ways, shapes, and forms. Of course, you can hear in the music, outgoing, boisterous, show-offy people generally don't write music that's that introspective and heartfelt. And plus, just the guts to write that kind of stuff at that time. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, it's difficult for someone today to realize that, because now we can write music that's very accessible because all the boundaries are gone. You can write anything you want now and not get well, I suppose, you know, you could write some terrible music that would get ridiculed, but you wouldn't be ridiculed for the style, because now it's a free-for-all in style, for better or for worse. But he was an outcast, I think, and you'd have to talk to his son to get a little bit more information about this, whether or not that was something the family ever talked about. But I certainly got the sense that he was out of the composer mainstream because he was writing neo-romantic music at a time that it was just socially unacceptable.
So yeah, now you can write anything. You'll always be able to find your tribe, and an opposing tribe, I guess, you know.
Yeah, and you can mix, of course. I mean, you know, you can mix styles. You can go from one to the other. If you're skilled, you can do it well. But it's difficult, of course, to go from one style to another. But anyway, yeah, you know, courageous, quiet, soft-spoken, gentle guy who was a very beautiful creator of a lot of others. I mean, some of the wind ensemble music and other things. We know him, or yeah, some percussionists know him only because of Variations, My Lady White, Crown of Thorns, Honer. But my gosh, that's a small part of his output.
It's great to hear your Temple Block story, because I feel like I've heard that story so many times from people trying to get a piece for just vibraphone or a piece for just snare drum or just marimba. And you hear that so many times. Well, the composer came back and said, well, could I write for vibraphone and crotales? They like immediately want to add something. And it's just, I guess, shows how new we are. Because if they were asked to write a piano piece, they wouldn't think twice about asking the pianist, could it be a trio? Could it be a quartet? Like, no, it's a piano solo. It's an established.
So could you put one hand on a harpsichord, the other hand on the piano?
Yeah. How about temple blocks?
Or temple blocks, yeah, with that. Let's see. Well, I guess let's go ahead and dive into Facebook. We got a lot of Facebook questions, and I think I'm just going to start with kind of a fun, easy one, but it's from Vincent Fernandez. He's asked questions before. Thanks, Vincent. And he just wants to know, speaking of rep, what's your most challenging piece you've ever played?
I had the reputation, I guess, of doing a lot of challenging pieces. But a lot of the problems were somewhat self-imposed or imposed by the composer due to schedule. I think a story I've probably told before, I hope it's not on that other podcast, but when I did my New York City debut in 79, in fact, there's another question here I noticed later on about the New York City Town Hall concert. I very foolishly, being quite full of myself, thought I could do, and I thought it would be a great thing also to do, two world premieres. So I scheduled the Sarry Night Rhapsody and Helbel Toccata Fantasy for the same night, world premiere, first time to ever play in front of people. Completely suicidal. It was the 4, 5, 6 months leading up to that were among the worst, most stressful months of my life. And I came up to the point about 6 or 8 weeks before the concert, and I realized I was going to crash, and I couldn't possibly play the Night Rhapsody from memory. And it's not the kind of piece that you can read. You can't put that up on a music stand. It'll be no help at all. It'll be a distraction. And the great thing about that was that it brought me back to my roots with Vita Chenoweth, because I knew very well what I had to do to learn it in time. And that was to stop playing it. I don't mean to be too philosophical here. I'm not trying to, it's sort of a trick statement, but what she taught me was not to memorize at the instrument, but to memorize in your brain. And I had done this with her in the early 70s. This was now late 70s. I knew exactly what I had to do, but I was avoiding it because it's the hardest work that I ever do at the marimba. I put the score down on the desktop and I looked at it and I studied it for about 3 weeks and never played a note until I could go through the piece entirely in my head without moving a muscle. And that saved my butt. I probably didn't play it great, but I was able to get through it beginning to end as a world premiere from memory that night. And never would have been able to do that had I not been brought back to basic principles that I was taught from Vita Chenoweth in New Zealand in 71 and 72 and the subsequent years that I studied with her. So that was the hardest piece from the standpoint of a deadline. I mean, it's a brutally difficult piece anyway. It's a fringe kind of a piece, but that's probably not the hardest piece I ever learned. Probably the hardest piece I ever learned is one movement of Seri's West Side Suite, the Passacaglia movement. And if you have a pirate copy of that, you know exactly what I'm talking about. The five against three rhythms, and it's fugal. It's not a fugue, but it is a Passacaglia for sure. And the one hand, one heart tune is passed around among the voices, but frequently in conflicting polyrhythms, which, if they sound like polyrhythms, will spoil the piece. It has to swing. And so that was probably the single toughest 3 or 4 minutes, musically speaking. And then not to overlook Raymond Helbel, because we've got the 9 preludes that were written for me. And there isn't anyone in the 9 preludes that's not right at the fringe of what you can do on the instrument. So I'd say that's the group of pieces, the Surrey Night Rhapsody, the Surrey West Side Suite, and singling out the Passacaglia movement because of the musical difficulties, the Helbel Toccata Fantasy, Helbel preludes. And the fantastic thing about that is it's not just difficult, unsatisfying music. All of those pieces I just mentioned are great pieces of music, in my opinion.
Well, you know, I think that what you mentioned, Lee, about memorizing the piece away from the instrument is so helpful and important, because so many of us, it happens to everyone sometimes, we memorize with muscle memory as we're playing. So that is very cool to hear from you. I have a follow-up question to this. What has been your favorite piece to perform over the years?
I guess I wasn't prepared for that, so I didn't really think that through, but a favorite piece would be one that I feel totally comfortable with. And there's almost nothing I feel totally comfortable with. There's always something going wrong. I was just discussing last night, two nights ago, Mike Burritt had a fantastic performance in Kilburn Hall at Eastman for the inauguration of a funded gift to the university to fund his professorship. And he did about an hour long solo recital there, and we compared notes the following morning and talked, because he's a good buddy of mine. And you know, we always, as performers, I'm sure if I were at one of your concerts or you were at one of mine, and if we were hanging out afterwards, we'd talk about I had trouble in this or I had trouble in that. The audience probably doesn't know that, but getting back to this, we were comparing notes I didn't like what I did over here or whatever. And I was reminded my Bach coach, Dorothy Payne, from the Eastman School of Music, who was also my theory teacher there, she taught me a lesson even before Vita Chenoweth taught me the lesson about memorization. And that was basically, she said, about every 60 seconds, something's going to go really wrong when you're on stage. And you just have to keep it at a professional level. You have to, you know, recover, go on. Don't let it bug you. Something's going to go wrong the next minute. This won't feel exactly right. You're going to miss that note, or you're not going to phrase it exactly the way you want. And you just have to keep it up above that 90 or 95% level. So circling back to your question, It's supposed to be fun. People think this is fun. And I love to play the marimba by myself. I don't enjoy performing generally. For me, that's work. When I put on my dress shoes and stuff backstage, I'm thinking, all right, Lee, you got to go to work now. And for the next hour, it's really hard, stressful work. So if I could get the check without doing the performance, I would absolutely opt for that all the time. So when you're asking me, what's my favorite piece? I don't know. I guess just in retrospect, if something went fairly smoothly, then for the night, that's my favorite piece. I will say it's much easier to compose in the style of Lee Stevens because he doesn't really have a style. He write, you know, every piece I write is sort of a different thing because there's a decade between pieces. But it's much easier on my own music to improvise my way out of a problem than it is in J.S. Bach.
Of course.
I have a quick little tidbit to add to that. First of all, on the other podcast, you did talk about how you love the preparation. It's just the going out on stage part that's, yeah, it's work, like you said. But this, whenever someone says, what's your favorite piece? What's your favorite timpani excerpt? What's your, you know, there's this old quote from Bill Mersch that always comes to mind and says, my favorite piece is the one I'm playing right now. Okay. And I bring that up to my students because, you know, it's like, who's your favorite girlfriend? The one you have right now.
That one I would agree on.
Right. Who's the best girlfriend in the world? Your current one. Right. So, yeah, with pieces, you can't be playing a piece and in the back of your mind have some other favorite piece that you're. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Not telling
and
us.
There are, you know, there are plenty of people around, although I think they should be punished in some other way in life with some other affliction. But there are plenty of people around who actually enjoy performing. And, you know, they actually get off and they can't wait to get on stage and show what they can do. And I'm not going to mention any names, but I know a few people like that. And I'm jealous of that. I'm not jealous of the rest of their lives. But
they're like, okay, so this is so cool. They're like so different, you know, like because I enjoy the work in the office and definitely the work like in your, like an artist in their art studio, it's just them and their composition, them and their instrument. And there's like a track of enjoyment that follows. Mm-hmm. And like, I generally enjoy performing. I mean, when I'm really, really prepared and I feel like, oh yeah, I'm going to nail it. It's like, that's really fun, but it's a different track of enjoyment. Like they're almost not even in the same soup to me. They satisfy different needs, I guess. Mm-hmm. But we were not going to get too philosophical, and I ruined it. Well, you know, we have two Facebook questions along these same lines. One is regarding this John Serry West Side Suite, and it's from Hector Rodriguez. And you've said this a lot, but wanted to know how much you had to practice that. But I think you've said that well. And you mentioned if you have a pirated or bootleg copy, he wants to know where can I get this John Serry West Side Suite piece. And what do you know about its hardness to get, I guess?
Well, the hardness to get is because when the piece was complete, the people who were in charge of Leonard Bernstein's life at that point, his agents, his copy, I mean, he had staff, he had people, really people in the sense of, you know, how a famous rap artist today might have people. And you had to get any rights to a piece or an arrangement or anything like that, you had to go through his staff. And although Leonard Bernstein was a fan of John Serry's music, he had actually called John one time at a party. The phone rang and somebody said, oh, somebody says he's Leonard Bernstein, and handed the phone to John. Of course, there was no cell phones. He said, what? You know, who's crapping around? And they picked up the phone and Leonard Bernstein saying, John, this is, you know, Leonard, I won't try to do the accent or anything. John, this is Leonard Bernstein calling. I'm at a party in Manhattan and we're playing your album. And I just want to let you know, it's fantastic music. Thank you. But, you know, have a great day. Goodbye. So, so he knew some of John's compositions. The West Side Suite was played for him. He loved it. We had I have a sort of a bogus, not bogus, it's a pirate recording in the sense that it's not legal to duplicate it or use it for commercial purposes. And it was done when the ink was still damp on the piece in the Eastman Theater. I think I had a couple of hours after Mike set up, and I just ran take after take after take after take. And it was all tape, you know, quarter inch, 7.5 or 15 inches per second tape. And then it was just razor blade sort of put together into like the least offensive takes. I put together a couple of big edit points, which I can still hear, unfortunately, as a demo to send to Leonard Bernstein's people to try to get the rights to publish it. And we just couldn't get in the door. Just couldn't get in the door. One guy wrote this nasty letter to John about how this is such an abhorrent thing to take this beautiful music and play it on the marimba. And so the piece, basically the public aspect of publishing it, having it recorded and so forth, was squashed. Now, I haven't done anything on that in 20 years. Haven't probably played it in 20 years. John Serry himself would be in charge of it. If you were going to get a copy, you'd have to track him down. I think he lives in Italy. And you know, and there's some recordings, some really good tries on YouTube, I think, of people playing it. At least I've been told. I haven't actually.
Mark Bozeman, yeah.
Mark has played it. Okay, so Mark's a great musician. I'm sure he does a great job with it. So Mark got a copy somehow, certainly not from me, but he got a copy. And it's just not until somebody, and let me back up, it won't be John Serry who makes the, makes the inroads and charms the piece, charms the copyright people, because he's not a very, he's a difficult person. Let's just leave it at that. So I don't think John has the skill set to go to the copyright holders and get permission, but maybe someday somebody will. It's a fantastic piece. It is an homage to Bernstein, and a very respectful one, and a beautifully done one. I hope, you know, that maybe someday it can see the light of day. I was thinking of trying to do that again myself at some point, but I have my own, you know, bucket list of other pieces I want to record. So I don't know if I'll ever go back to it again, but there is that. I know people have copies of my recording because it was sent out for a variety of different things, and it's leaked and it's out there. And I'm not humiliated by it, but it's not a perfect recording. There's some bloopers in there.
Sure.
So while we're along these lines, we actually had a couple of Facebook questions from Kai Stinsgaard and Micah Detweiler. And something I wanted to ask as well, I remember around 2004 or so, I had a conversation with Mark Ford, and this was after Mark had just recorded the double marimba concerto with Keiko Abe, and he said he had a conversation with her and basically said, listen, we need to have a video of Keiko Abe performing, like that needs to be a thing that exists. And at the time, that was the first, at least commercial video of her produced, and she had recorded CDs before as well. And Lee, on the Malatech website, I know now there's a clip of you performing the end of Rhythmic Caprice. Do you have, you mentioned sort of in passing, you have some pieces you'd like to record. Do you have any upcoming plans, if you feel comfortable talking about that, to record audio and or video?
Well, I would like to. For me, it's a battle against the clock. Not in any, I don't mean like in a terminal illness. I don't want anybody to think I'm ill. I'm not. But but I mean, a battle against the clock in terms of just all the things that I enjoy doing. I'm involved in so many different things. I saw a question here about the mallet company and I don't know if the instrument company and so on. So I'm torn in a million different directions. I happen to be writing a piece right now because Houdini's Last Trick is finally now engraved, and it's a couple of hours of my work away from being ready to be published. It should be out by this next PASIC. The cover's done even. My guy, David Eng at Keyboard Percussion Publications did a fantastic cover for it. So everything's coming together on that. And I needed to put that to bed before I wrote another piece. And I've got stacks. I mean, I don't know whether you could, this is maybe not, Skype etiquette, but can you see what's going on? I mean, can you see like the stack of music there and everything? This is my studio, incidentally, if you can't see. I don't know what you're seeing, but this is my new Roland piano, about 1 month old. Beautiful.
Fun.
FP90. My God, it sounds better than a real piano. I've got all these sketches enough to write 20 pieces if I had the time. And I do want to record, I want to videotape some of the cello suites, because I'm doing some really new things there in Bach performance that I want to get, I want students to see it. I want other professionals to see it. And I just want to get that music down. Whether I would do an entire suite or not, it's probably not. I want to do Houdini's Last Trick in a video. I have a an idea for how to do that. But it's all a battle against, you know, when am I going to do this? I have this company. I have responsibilities. I'm developing mallets for Joe Locke and Escape 10 and working on a new vibraphone design for the Team Omega guys. And there's just so much going on. And I enjoy a lot of that. So, yeah, I have plans. I haven't done a new recording. Well, that's not true. We released Beads of Glass by Gordon Stout, Fissinger Suite, and Great Wall maybe 2 years ago or 3 years ago. So I have done some recording, but not videotaping. And that, I know that's the way you're supposed to do it now. So I'll do it. But when it's going to happen, I can't tell you.
So speaking of Houdini's Last Trick, I wouldn't have believed this unless I knew this person so well, but Caleb Pickering has spoken of this, and he says, one time I saw you levitate a table playing a piece. I believe you called it Houdini's Last Trick. There's no way I'm misremembering it. Did you study, and do you study magic as a hobby?
I wouldn't call it a hobby. And I levitated the table, but it was only a trap table. So, you know, that's not like a car or airplane. So I'm not in that kind of a league.
He described you as a very trained, skilled magician.
That would be an exaggeration or a misperception.
Okay.
But I have dabbled in it. And here's the problem. The piece can be played successfully and probably more successfully without any magic in it. But there is a point at which one of the Houdini tricks, I mean, it's partly about marimba tricks. So it has some tricky little things that only marimba players would realize is hard. Like in the very opening of the piece, I'm doing something at the top of the instrument and I go, bam, like this. And I grab a note way down there and roll on it with one hand. And so it has some humorous things like that. But overall, it's kind of a serious, sick kind of a piece. And there's a spot at the very end with that same thing, boom, that low F sharp rolled. And you could walk around, as I've done, I've spent a lot of time on this. I walk around, pivot on that F sharp to the other side of the instrument. And then I replay the last four or six bars or whatever what I just played, but from the wrong side. And incidentally, Warren Wolf, the great vibraphone genius, does this better than I do. If you've seen Warren Wolf's videos where they just start improvising, go to the other side and jam just as if he's on the correct side of the instrument. It's sick, truly sick. Mine's rehearsed.
He's wonderful, yeah.
Anyway, I went around there and I had a series of illusions that I created, about 60 seconds of it, and then went back and finished the piece. And then people thought, wow, that was the magic of Houdini's Last Trick. But that wasn't the main trick, because the main trick then was when the piece was done, I levitated the table and went off stage with it and came back and did Rhythmic Caprice. So now here's the issue. The issue is that magic is hard and expensive.
And expensive, yeah.
Yes, magic. A good magic, good illusion is very expensive. And I don't do Las Vegas, so I don't have that kind of a budget. And I don't go with a crew to help me set up. I have to set up my own illusions. So I need time in a hall by myself without any snooping eyes to do really good magic. You need to do clever things.
That seems like a great gig for Mike Burritt to set up for you.
he could be the assistant.
So anyway, I don't do
he's not doing a whole lot these days, I don't think.
That I did the table levitation thing, because it takes a lot of practice. You have to do it beautifully. You see these guys, they have, you know, quarters and they just, you know, they roll them on the fingers and stuff. That's all years
of practice. So, yeah. The closest thing I've ever, I know this isn't about me. This is about Lee Howard Stevens, so I'd feel silly even saying anything. But y'all know my piece for snare drum with the little metronome and the brushes.
Yeah.
So And it's been described as a magic trick. Like, Casey, how did you do that? The idea is that you wind the metronome and you play the piece, and it's supposed to unwind and stop ticking, like, at the perfect moment at the end. And if you time it right, it'll do that. And you practice it enough, you learn, yeah, the metronome will unwind, like, right at the right moment. And one time I was doing it, and right when I put my hand up and, you know, did the hands-off magic trick to make it stopped right on time. And this kid in the audience, I think high school kid or something, just went, holy shit! Like, really, it's silence. It's totally silence at that part in the piece. So it was it was really, really a blast. But people say, like, oh, is there a string tied to your foot or something? Or so, I don't know. I wish I could do magic. All I can do is that.
Anybody can do magic. It just takes as much time to learn magic as it does to learn a musical instrument.
And can't do that. Trying to do that one still.
I know. That's what I'm saying. The Houdini is a hard piece, and I was spending time, you know, an hour or so a day working on the magic in front of a mirror to make sure that it all worked and I wasn't doing something stupid. And it's, again, it's setup time, and it's, I love it. I mean, I love the idea because some of these guys are just so, so skilled and they're so clever. You know, there are people, I've been to Las Vegas, but I've never seen a magic show there, but there's an industry of just really, really clever people. If you want to see a really spooky movie, you may know it already, but it's called The Prestige.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
fantastic
with
movie.
David Bowie in it, I'll add.
I'm sorry?
Is that right?
Yeah, David Bowie's in it, yeah.
Oh, you know, I didn't realize that. Yeah.
Have you seen the new Penn & Teller reality show where the magicians come on and try to impress them? And
I've seen Penn & one of my original thoughts about trying to find a way to do a little magic on the side was when I saw Penn & Teller on Broadway 35, 40 years. I don't know when it was. When I lived in Manhattan, I went to a Penn & Teller show and was absolutely flabbergasted at what they did right in front of people.
I watched
flying all over the stage and all sorts of horrors. But of course, it's all in good fun.
And it's just them is what amazes me about them. I mean, I know they have all sorts of help and a crew and it's all so planned out, but I mean, it's an epic show and it's just the two of them and they're hilarious. And there's a documentary on The Amazing Jonathan that came out recently. Did you guys ever watch The Amazing Jonathan in the 90s?
No.
Comedian magician. Really, really funny. Yeah. I think we have a Facebook question, right, Carly?
Yeah. Changing gears a little bit. This one's from the great Beverly Johnston. And she says, Lee Stevens has developed one of the most popular and effective grips for four mallet playing. What are the main issues with beginners learning the Stevens grip? And have you, Lee, noticed any changes over the years in how the grip is being used by professional musicians?
That's interesting. Well, a couple of thoughts that I would have. The first thing is that I don't teach beginners very frequently. I teach high school students sometimes in summer, and some of those are beginners. So I would say if the technique is taught properly as a loose, relaxed hang and not a grip, then there are very few issues. We do need better teaching materials for young students to learn that technique. And I was actually thinking, again, it's all time permitting, of doing like a mini MOM, because most middle school kids probably see Method of Movement and they go, oh my God, there's diagrams in there and all sorts of threatening things. But to do a sort of a mini MOM where it would have just the basics. And I would like to see marimba taught. This is something that you guys could take up if you think it's a good idea, do better than I could and probably a decade faster. I think we should be teaching it a little bit like rhythm guitar. When I was a junior high school student, probably, I first started to play guitar. And at first I had an acoustic Framus, and then I got an electric guitar. But I was a rhythm guitar player. I couldn't play scales. I couldn't play arpeggios or anything. I didn't really know on the keyboard where the notes really were. I just knew all the chords, and I could do cool rhythms and everything with it. But it was tremendously satisfying to play it because I could play all this harmonic material. And I think the proper, with the proper approach, somebody maybe it has to be a jazz guy. Maybe a classical guy isn't the right person to do this, but a jazz person might be able to write out really cool rhythms. So somebody who's practicing as a drummer and can already do pretty complex rhythms between the hands on the drum set could pick up four sticks and do really fun things on a marimba and not have to worry about reading the notes or any of that other stuff. Just make music with it, give them chord progression. I'm not going to say to do it through tablature, but so to answer Beverly, the problems are because of our methodology. That method of movement is not a proper place for a middle school kid to learn the technique. There's some other books that have been written that are probably more appropriate, but I've never seen one that bases it on making music with four mallets immediately and taking advantage of the fact that most of those students are percussionists who can do way more complicated things rhythmically and just need to say, play that rhythm on these notes and then switch to these notes. So I think there's a whole methodology that someday somebody will write that will make the entree to the technique much easier for young people and more accessible and more satisfying. So they don't have to start working on scales with the two inner mallets and let the outer ones stay still. And that requires a lot of discipline and the desire to be a great player later on. It's a real hassle to work on that stuff unless you're driven to really want to be a great player. As far as the second part of Beverly's question, I know for my own sake, it's a really esoteric little point, but it's really important. I see people following method of movement very, very strictly with a very vertical hand position, even when it's demonstrably awkward to keep the vertical hand position. Case in point would be something like, let's say, E and G sharp with the right hand, and they'll sort of bend their wrist around and they get into all these contorted positions. It's covered thoroughly in method of movement that when you put an accidental on the outside mallet, the hand position flattens, but people are maybe they didn't read that far into the book and they just saw that it's basically a vertical hand position. To put it in historical context, what nobody would have any reason to realize is that was one of the most difficult aspects of getting that technique accepted. The fact that you were holding your hands, quote, like a timpani player. You weren't supposed to play marimba like a timpani player. You're supposed to play marimba and xylophone matched grip, air quotes. So when they saw a player playing with vertical hand position, there was a lot of resistance to it. And I had to emphasize that vertical hand position in method of movement because the time when it was published in 1979, there was great resistance to the idea that you could even get a good sound out of the instrument with a birch stick, or that you could get a good sound out of the instrument holding the sticks at the end with a vertical hand position. There were so many hurdles, psychological hurdles, that perhaps I overemphasized the vertical nature of the technique. Because I don't play strictly vertical. My hands are over at 45 degrees a good portion of the time, and all the great players I know play over to a certain degree. So that's something that I think has changed over time. My realization that people are taking some of the stuff should be taken literally in the book, and people don't, and other things are being taken too literally, and they haven't read the next chapter where it talks about flattening the hand position.
I speaking of beginners and Bev's question, I often notice that people are trying to follow, like you mentioned, like one little rule, and it might not even come from your book. It'll come from front ensemble. They have to look a certain way. And you tell them, well, like, no, you should really turn, or you should flatten your hand here so you can get that F sharp E natural angle in the right hand or something. And they're just very, very resistant to do it. It's like, oh, but that makes me violate this one rule that I need to audition for front ensemble for WGI or something. It's like, ah, shoot, this is not helping. But I wanted to share one quick little story, which was when I think I was maybe a freshman or sophomore in college. I got to play for Lee Howard Stevens at, I think it was the University of Utah, something like that. It was Weber State University. You were there as a clinician, and I played for you, and I was so nervous because I was that
I was
middle
nervous
school.
Too, Casey, thinking this is going to be one of the more famous players later on. I better give him a good lesson.
No, I played some shit, something for you, you know, you know, something little. But I remember thinking like, oh no, like I haven't followed the method to a T. And I was that kid in middle school who didn't want to read everything in the beginning and really, really be thorough about it. I just wanted to get there and play. But you know, I played well, and you were so gracious, and you said, okay, that was great, thank you, and your technique is really, really good. You don't play my technique quite right, but it's great. It's working for you. Do it. Don't change a thing. And that kept with me for so long, and I still tell that story right now when I've got a student who says, oh, but if I turn my wrist, I'll violate this little rule in front ensemble or whatever. And I say, well, you know what? And I get to tell that story.
No, that's interesting, and I'm glad I handled it that way because I maybe didn't in all cases, but I'm glad I did in your case. And the flip side of that, though, is the following that I would offer up. There are certain things in method of movement that are, they're not deep truths because I wrote them, but they're deep truths because it's the way the universe works. There's some physics and some things about the way you hit the instrument, the way the strokes should be shaped, the way the movement should come off of the bar to a new position. Those things are should be sacrosanct. And so there are things in there in the technique. And I would say when I work with my college students in my summer program in June, we go back to very basic principles, and we work on things very strictly, not tight, not strict in the sense of what you were talking about in terms of the frontline WGI, but very strictly in terms of here's what should happen. Here's how the timing of the elements should be. Here's what you should be feeling partway down, because if you can get those fundamentals correct, meaning working with Mother Nature and not fighting Isaac Newton, then you can play however the hell you want, because you have an athletic, beautiful approach to the instrument that isn't fighting inertia, momentum, conservation of energy, you know, all of these things that we can either fight or allow to work with us. So some aspects of the technique, for sure, people take too literally, but the business about how the strokes are produced and how you shift, how you move around the instrument, those weren't invented by me. I just applied them to the marimba.
Yeah, sure. Ben, I think you have a question?
Yeah, so Lee, moving in a different direction, I'm sitting here looking at Carly sitting in front of a whole lot of rosewood, and Casey sitting in front of a whole lot of rosewood, and we saw your rosewood, and I heard some rosewood across the hall, and we had a Facebook question from Brendan Lynch that I think is very important to discuss, and he says, with the release of Malitech's M-Tech line of instruments, do you think it's possible to have a professional quality of the instrument not made from rosewood? How do you feel about synthetic instruments like Mode marimbas, and where do you see the instrument being 50 years from now in regards to rosewood and materials?
Well, I have no clue for the 50-year question, other than material science is plowing ahead at a very, very fast clip. Now, there's not much trickle down to our little area of keyboard percussion instruments because our market is so tiny. You can't spend $1 million on developing the perfect rosewood replacement. But that's not to say that it isn't possible or won't be possible in the next 50 years. I just finished a video, I don't even think it's been posted yet, about the M-Tech marimbas, which is one of the things when you're asking earlier, am I going to record? Well, I've been going back and forth to China a lot. And that gets in the way of practice and recording. And I've been working on developing this line of M-Tech. We call them near professional marimbas. It's really an insult to call them a student marimba because it looks, this is obviously a commercial coming up now. I'm the owner and founder of Malitech, but you can take it with a grain of salt or, you know, go listen and disagree with me if you want. But it's an insult to call them a student instrument because they're pretty damn good instruments and they're made from Padauk. And the video that I just finished showed how Padauk can sound better than rosewood. It's all a matter of selection and tuning, the acoustics of the coupling of the resonator. There's so many factors that go into a great sound. So if you are not very select in your Rosewood keyboard, or you're not very select in how you tune it. And it's not a question of just tuning that bar. It's really the overtones and what we call at Malatech harmonic matching. It's the overtones of a given note and how they coincide or don't coincide, conflict, or are consonant with other notes, other fundamentals on the instrument. So if you're careful about the tuning and you have a beautiful piece of rosewood, it can be a fantastic sound. But in reality, most marimbas are not fantastic. They're good. And sometimes the tuning is good. Sometimes it's less than good. And in this video, I just take two bars. I take an average rosewood bar and one of the Padauk bars off the MTech, and I hold them up to a mic. And you can hear, it's plain as day. I mean, not on a little laptop like I'm listening right now, but on a, you know, with good headphones or through a speaker system, you hear plain as day. The Padauk bar is better than the rosewood bar. So it's about selection, care, and tuning, and the fundamental design of the instrument, coupling the right size resonators to that size bar. There's so much that goes into it. So will there be better and better synthetics? Yes, there will be. The synthetics now are pardon my French, they're piss poor. They don't sound anything remotely like wood. Good Padauk sounds just like wood. One, with your back turned, if you listen to a great Padauk note, if you have a very sensitive ear, you might say, that's a little darker than the rosewood I normally play. But that's like saying that the Burzendorfer is darker than the Steinway. The Yamaha Concert Grand is brighter than the Steinway. Those are little factors. The ring time of good Padauk bars is fantastic. They're a little darker in timbre, and the jury is out as to whether or not they're more or less fragile.
Are they more sustainable?
Oh, infinitely, from what I know. And I'm not super expert in this, but I think also because it's a softer wood, it probably grows faster. I don't know. You know, it's an interesting question. I should know the answer to that right off the top of my head, but I don't. I know that Padauk also grows in a couple of different environments because it's harvested in different places. So I think one of the things there, of course, any renewable resource would be preferable. And rosewood grows very, very slowly. And I don't know whether, I mean, I've heard rumors that Yamaha bought this forest and they're planting rosewood. I don't know whether that's really true because rosewood in its natural state grows on mountain slopes. You know, you will not have it like a pine grove. It's up on the sides of the mountain, and they go in with donkeys and stuff up there, and they cut the thing and they drag it back down. So I don't know whether that is something that can actually be planted for replenishment purposes. And I don't know the answer really about Padauk, other than Padauk is so much less expensive than rosewood. I'm assuming it's more plentiful and more easily cultivated.
Yeah, we talked to Ron Samuels a while back of Marimba One, and we talked extensively about rosewood with him. And that was one thing I found in my research is, as far as my research came up with, it cannot be harvested. It has to be, I can't remember the exact reason, but it has to be naturally found. Well, Casey, I think you had a few history items to share with us today.
Yeah, sure. So I thought I'd give you all your little trivia for the day. And we're releasing on October 10th. So stuff that happened on October 10th is kind of a birthday theme today. And I'm going to shoot it over to Ben with a question real quick. There are two Giuseppe composers that share the same birthday. One of them is Giuseppe Verdi. And the other one, I bet you can guess because we've talked about him before, Giuseppe.
Oh, I was going to say Verdi.
Verdi's one, but the other one, I don't know. Giuseppe we've talked about? Giuseppe.
Chelsea.
It's Paul Creston. Remember, Yeah, his birth name, Sicilian name, is Giuseppe Gudovegio. And yeah, he was born in 1906 on October 10th, and so was Verdi. And I thought I'd just look up a few fun things about Paul Creston that you may not have known, and you may know because you've listened to the show before and heard Ben's segment on it. But the first, of course, is that his actual name, Giuseppe Gudovegio, to change it to Paul Creston when he came to the U.S. Self-taught composer. In addition to the marimba concerto that we all know and love him for, he also wrote two accordion concertos and two saxophone concertos. He was also a known and famous teacher and trained the very famous composer John Corigliano. He also wrote two books in the realm of music theory. They're called Principles of Rhythm in 1964 and the Rational Metric Notation in 1979. Another birthday on October 10th is Thelonious Monk. And you may not know, but Thelonious Monk's son is a very famous and proficient jazz drummer. His name is T.S. Monk. It stands for Thelonious Sphere Monk. And something he says about his father, just a few fun facts about Thelonious Monk, is his father was classically trained pianist, not a jazz musician to begin with, and he also loved to play Yahtzee, a board game with dice. He and his wife would play for hours on end this dice game called Yahtzee that I think we probably most of us know. He loved to play Happy Birthday for people he was close to, so Thelonious Monk on people's birthdays would show up at their house, go into the home, and play an original arrangement of Happy Birthday for them. And last piece of news is that Porgy and Bess premiered and opened on Broadway on October 10th in 1935. And instead of diving into that, I thought I would just play the excerpt for you guys. Is that okay? No. Okay.
Yeah, go for it. We can't remember how it sounds, so.
Right, exactly.
Haven't heard it in a while.
See, it was funny, exactly. Anyway, so that's just some fun facts what happened on this episode's release date. And I thought it was pretty dang cool that Creston's birthday on the day that we're our guest happens to be Lee Howard Stevens. So. Hey everyone, I'm going to make the cut here and call this part one since it was a pretty long episode. So lots more good stuff next week. And yeah, please join us for part two of the Lee Howard Stevens episode. And thank you all so much.